Hello there and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Pro. And as ever, I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Mr. Tom Bassam, our off-platform editor here at Sports Pro. Tom, it's been a few weeks since we've hit the mics together. Have you missed me?
Hit the mics. I like that. Yeah, always, George. Missed you dearly. Last week, what did we have? Oh, we had Laureus, didn't we? That was a great pod, actually. Brian Habana, Harish Sharma from TikTok. Able replacements, but no George Breer.
That's probably the nicest thing you've ever said to me, Tom. I'm beginning to tear up here. But alongside us both today, we're also delighted to be welcoming the Movember-filled motorsport writer at Blackburn Motorsport, Kian Brittle. Kian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back, George.
It's good to have you here. We're chatting to you this week ahead of the most glitz and glamour event in the calendar. I'm not talking, of course, about this podcast. Instead, it's the Las Vegas Grand Prix.
I can't really believe we're here, to be honest. The Las Vegas Grand Prix almost seems like a fever dream almost. This massive mega event that just so happens to have an F1 race at the end of it. The logistical effort to get here has been enormous, which I'm sure we'll get into later in this podcast. But looking forward to it.
From a purely sporting point of view, before we dive into the bottom line, et cetera, are you excited for this weekend?
I'm excited to see how it goes. I think it's going to be interesting, to say the least, just in terms of racing in a desert in the middle of the night when temperatures will be quite cold. So it should be interesting to see how sort of F1 cars cope with that, considering tyres usually have to run at fairly hot temperatures.
This is all getting a bit too technical for my liking. Tyres, temperatures, middle of the night. This is not what people tune into the Sports Pro podcast for.
It's the heart of sport, Tom.
It's true.
They tune in, of course, for the entertainment. Yeah, don't they, Tom? Exactly. And that really is what the Las Vegas Grand Prix is all about.
Yeah, nothing says entertainment like tyre temperatures. I think, to be honest, the most entertaining part of the Las Vegas Grand Prix for me has been how we got here. It's pretty mad. Kian, were you alive when the last Las Vegas Grand Prix ran? I don't think anyone in this room was alive when the last.
I don't think anyone was. Last race was in 1981 or 82, so it's been a while.
Even venerable boss of Black Book Motorsport, Peter Jones, wasn't alive, I don't think.
That is very, very true.
And so its incarnation, much like the three of us in this room, has caused quite a stir over the past couple of weeks. It's a bit of a departure from Formula One's normal approach to race partnerships. In fact, it's not really a partnership at all.
Well, yes, this is the first time F1 have ever promoted a race themselves. So it is completely brand new. Obviously, with that, you expect a lot more freedom for F1 in how they want to set up this event. I don't think this event would exist if F1 hadn't promoted it themselves. But at the same time, then you've got the added pressure of having to deliver as the rights holder, which is something obviously F1 has never had to do before. It's going to be interesting to see how, I guess, that sort of comes off for them in the long term. But as Tom said, it's been entertaining just to see how we've got to this point over time.
When you say you don't know how it would have got here if it wasn't for F1 promoting it itself, what do you mean?
Just in terms of, I guess, the pull that the F1 and Liberty Media have, I don't think if an independent race promoter had gone to sort of the local casinos, the local authority, and said, we want to put on an F1 race, they would have probably been laughed out of the room. But when you've got F1 themselves coming and saying, we can do this, we have the money to do this, conversations obviously are going to happen a lot more fluidly as a result of that.
And by all accounts, those conversations did take place and they didn't go anywhere, right? And I know you've spoken with Emily Prazer, who's the chief commercial officer for the Grand Prix, and she said that actually it was Liberty Media coming to the table, really sort of making that statement saying, we can do this, we want to do this, and we definitely have the portfolio of businesses under that Liberty Media umbrella.
Yeah,
I think it's Live Nation and Liberty Dice that have sort of led on that process and to say, you know, we're going to do this, and sort of the city and its partners have sort of risen to that challenge alongside it.
Yeah, so Liberty Media created Liberty Dice specifically for this event, just to, I guess, show how serious they really were about promoting it. I don't really know many sporting organisations that could put up $240 million off the bat to purchase that 39-acre site where they've now got the paddock building. So I think sort of that highlights, I guess, sort of the different levels when it comes to this, just in terms of, as I said before, I don't think it would have been possible if F1 and Liberty Media hadn't pushed for it.
Tom, I actually wanted to dive into that with you a little bit more. So for those that may not be, you know, that knowledgeable on the ins and outs of what it takes to host a major event, or what the sort of commercial agreements are when it comes to hosting major events, typically that relationship is through a third party, right? Through an event organizer, but this is slightly different.
Yeah, so that's actually what I was going to try and explain briefly.
Great minds.
Wonderful podcasters. typically Formula One will take an event, say we want to do a Grand Prix here, a local organizing committee will, an organization will basically acquire the rights to do so from F1. So they will acquire the license to put on an event. In the UK, for example, that's the folks at Silverstone, that's the Monaco Grand Prix Authority, or whatever they're calling themselves these days, in Monaco, Singapore, blah, blah, all the way around the world. Each one has its own organizer. They give F1 a certain amount of money to put those races on. But for this Grand Prix, yeah, as we sort of discussed, F1 are doing this all themselves. So they're not receiving a license fee. They are fronting all of the costs. They are agreeing all of the different elements that you need to put on an event of that size. And it's a massive size. And as Kian said, they're actually buying up bits of land and building things in order to make this happen. So it's a huge outlay. Like, it's so, so different to anything F1's done before. I guess this definitely wouldn't have happened previously under Bernie Ecclestone, because he was the man that loved to take F1 races to weird places because they give him money for it. And the idea of spending his own money on doing something like that would be almost anathema to the way that he ran the business. So the Liberty to do this is a kind of big show of like, okay, we really think that this is the market where it's going to happen for us. They now have three US races, so Miami, Kota, and now this Vegas race. But this is by far their biggest commitment to doing so, because they took the traditional model in Miami, licensed out to Stephen Ross, the guy who owns the Miami Dolphins. But this one, yeah, they've taken all those costs themselves, because the idea that they must be thinking, all right, we've got to put all this money in up front, but ultimately, and I think we'll probably come on to how they're doing this, but ultimately we think that we can make loads back in return, or at least it'd be worthwhile for our business on the whole in the US for us to be in Vegas.
And that's sort of at the heart of the dilemma when it comes to rights holders, right? Is that putting on a major event comes with significant risk, but also significant reward. There's enormous capital expenditure involved with hosting major events, like venue acquisition, etc. You know, all of the things that go into, you know, producing something for nearly 500,000 people. But it also comes with ownership of the rights, and therefore essentially unlimited upside if you can handle those properly. So for the traditional rights holder, you know, a regular licensing fee sort of sits as a bit of a halfway house there, right? They're able to have recurring, pretty comfortable, safe revenue purely for the exchange of licensing of the brand, really, and of the IP. But Formula One's taken a completely different approach here, almost quite unprecedented, I'd say, in the way for a major rights holder, in which it said, we're going to make huge capital expenditure, not just in terms of the costs of organizing, of operational costs, but actually we're going to acquire a sizable asset. I think it's the tune of more than $240 million, which is a huge outlay. But then that comes with an asset that can be licensed for other parts of the year, that they'll retain for however long they want to. And then they're able to really maximize those rights over a much longer period of time. Kian, do you think that is a one-off with Formula One, and that's something that's kind of like earmarked or boxed off for Las Vegas only? Or do you see that being a slight shift in Formula One strategy towards retaining more of its rights and actually becoming an event producer?
I think if this is a successful event, I think it will set sort of the model for future expansion in F1. Obviously, I think the expenditure of Vegas potentially is a one-off. I can't see them, you know, rolling this out multiple times. As you say, $240 million on the paddock. It's been, I believe, $280 million this year alone, just on spending on further capital expenditure. I know targets were for that to stay sort of around $400 million. So we've obviously easily beaten that this year. I can't see that side of it being replicated elsewhere in the world. The whole idea of being the rights holder and promoting the event themselves, having that control, is something I think F1 will want to have moving forwards.
And while, you know, as you say, it's nearly $500 million in expenditure up to this point, already quite significantly over budget to the tune of 25% or so. As a test case, Las Vegas seems to be a pretty risky option as a first stab at this. So why have Formula One seen this model as ideally aligned to Las Vegas, as opposed to maybe a different location that would have significantly less capital expenditure up front?
I don't know whether it's just to do with the allure of Las Vegas. I mean, I think you see in many US sports, they all seem to want to target Las Vegas for franchise expansions. I guess this combination of excess kind of fits with Las Vegas and Formula One. I think this whole idea of Formula One cars racing down the strip.
Marketer's dream.
They honed in on it very quickly. They wanted it. And I think they just went after it, no matter what it would cost.
Interesting to go back onto your question about whether or not this is something that they would look to replicate. Like, the thing that is in Liberty's favour here, right, is that they own a events company in Live Nation. So they have their expertise in-house to draw upon. And I think you're probably right. They're not going to be spending $240 million on another paddock in, I don't know, say they want to launch a race in...
Iceland.
Yeah, I mean, no one's going to Reykjavik, but whatever. Not now with the volcano going off.
If they wanted to cater for the Asian market, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I imagine it would probably be something more of like a hybrid test case, but they then know that they have the infrastructure to do that and could pick up this model, obviously adapt it, because I think nothing is cookie cutter when it comes to putting on events, and take it over into new places. And it would be, quite a lot of the sort of the figures coming back from this is that F1 expects to bring in around $500 million in revenue, I think, from this event. Is that right?
That's what they're hoping for, yeah. Targeted anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, that's quite a lot of your money up front back from one event. You've got to think that repeats over and over again. So it's just, if they can make it work here, then yeah, I think Kian's probably right that it is something they could replicate. But that said, there is only one Vegas. I think this race... probably, and the way that they're doing this, certainly the way that they're marketing it and selling some of the packages around it, is completely unique. Like, it is only the only place really I think you could do that, the sort of adults playground that is Vegas.
I want to dive into the numbers in a little bit, because before that you used the phrase an adults playground, and it certainly seems as if Formula One have really lent into that model. Just a few of the things that I think, Kian, you said it was, you know, a weekend of entertainment with a race at the end. That does seem to be the case, just at a quick glance of the weekend's agenda. I know that there's the Netflix Cup that's being hosted, I think, this week between various Formula One drivers and various golfing stars, and is a bit of an intersection between Netflix's two series of Full Swing and Drive to Survive. I know that Live Nation, their big show that takes place the night before, featuring all 20 drivers. It really is the sort of American excess at its apogee this weekend, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if either of you watched the Miami Grand Prix with the sort of driver intros that they did with LL Cool J sort of doing over the top introductions, and followed by, I believe, a Will.i.am song. It was all just very American, and I think we're probably going to get more of the same with this. I think they're calling it an opening ceremony as well. Multiple musical acts performing. It is, to say it again, leaning into the excess of Las Vegas and of F1. Just the increasing Americanization of the sport, I think.
Mm. Tom, you referenced the sort of the parallels of Monaco. I think it's really interesting that it's sort of the way in which it's the city, the race itself, the identities are embedded in the same way that it is with Monaco. It almost seems as if it's sort of Monaco for the modern day or for the modern world. Do you think that's fair in its approach?
I think the comparison with Monaco is interesting, because obviously when you think of Monaco, you think of the F1 race. I mean, it's been in Monaco for so long. It's so entrenched in the local culture that I guess from the point of view of the disruption that the race causes when it's happening, it's almost an anticipated thing year by year in Monaco. Whereas with Vegas, I think there's been a lot of opposition from local residents because they're not used to having an F1 race being set up right in the middle of the city. It's quite a busy city, Las Vegas. I think residents have been, you know, up in arms for quite a while about this, just in terms of sort of disruption and the traffic issues that the construction has caused. I think Greg Maffei, who is the chief executive of Liberty Media, has even gone as far as to apologise to residents for sort of how far this has gone. So I think the Monaco example is interesting, because you've also got that comparison there of sort of an embedded race compared to this, you know, new race trying to sort of create an identity for itself.
That's a really interesting point, Tom. Like, not just from a embracing it culturally or embracing it from like a purely sort of what's the fit like or how does this sit within the residents, but actually financially that seems to be the case as well. I know that Formula One has sort of rowed back on its initial goal to charge a licensing fee for local venues, which was mooted around $1,500 a head, which I think was forecast for larger venues to be about $3 million in revenue per venue. They've now rowed that back to a kind of staggering drop to $50,000 per venue. As opposed to 3 million. So they've gone away from the per head model to being the per venue model, which I think is what's being followed for the Super Bowl for next year, which is being held in Las Vegas as well. So clearly there's not been the level of interest or the financial commitment from local venues that they were hoping for or that they were expecting. Do you think that's a bit of a strong correlation in what you're saying in terms of the local residents as well?
I think what I would say on that is that the licensing fee is quite a standard practice in F1. I think just with the size of the venues and the scale of the event itself, it perhaps maybe, you know, put out the local venues a little bit just to see sort of the level of the price tag that came about as a result of it. And, you know, with sort of the likes of Caesars and Wynn Resorts being founding partners of the event, I think there was definitely some negotiations there to sort of get that down to a more manageable level. But that licensing fee is standard practice for F1 when it races in cities.
Were you surprised to see the drop?
I was surprised to see how far it did drop. I think maybe F1 is confident in a way of the revenue that is going to come about from this event. Sort of the wider impact to the state itself, which I believe is to the tune of they're expecting $1.2 billion to be generated for the state of Nevada. I think, you know, the ensuing impact that F1 will gain from that and from the attention, perhaps this was something they could overlook.
Because it's interesting, you can kind of take it one of two ways, right? You can either see it as a bit of an abject failure from a commercial point of view. They're unable to, you know, extract those types of revenues from local partners, maybe because of a lack of interest. And there's, you know, we'll come on to them in a second, but there are some stats across other areas of the Grand Prix that suggest the interest hasn't quite matched expectations. But then there's the other side of looking at it, which is, you know, in an environment of maybe tension between local authorities, local residents, and the Grand Prix itself, particularly when, as we've already discussed, it's not being hosted by a local authority, that it's actually, let's waive this fee or let's substantially reduce it and really build that goodwill going into a longer term partnership.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is obviously a sense of trying to build that relationship moving forward, especially as you say, with the sort of local reaction. I know they've got a 3-year contract to race in Vegas, but they do have permits for 10 years. So it's not a permitting issue for F1 to continue here. They just need to have those commercial discussions. So I guess any talk of F1 sort of turning up in Vegas and this being a one and done, it's probably nonsense. I mean, this has been a massive investment for F1. They will be in Vegas for a while.
You definitely don't make a $250 million investment in infrastructure if you're planning on being there for a short period of time. Just talk me through the difference for listeners between that 10-year permitting deal and the 3-year commercial agreement. So what's the difference between the two and why do you think there's that 3-year break clause, I guess?
Well, the permitting deal is just with the Las Vegas local authority. So basically just they have permission to race there for 10 years, but they've only had the commercial discussions for 3. I'd imagine this was probably built around the fact that their commercial expectations were unknown when they started. So they'll have this 3 years and then this will allow them to reassess and then, I guess, build a contract that makes more sense for both parties.
So it's almost a reversal of the traditional relationship, right? Where Formula One is essentially taking a licensing fee from Las Vegas in order to have permission to race there. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, and that plays into the fact that this is F1's first time doing this.
And that's sort of Las Vegas almost essentially saying, rather than tying us into a longer term security and potentially losing out on immense upside 3 years into this partnership, if the forecasts were hit and they saw that incredible financial opportunity realized, there's a chance for them to come back to the table in 3 years' time and say, you know, we have a 7-year window. We can maximize a lot more of the share of those profits going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know whether they looked at Miami maybe, which had quite a successful first year and then a little bit of a dip in the second and thought maybe we wait and see whether there's a novelty factor to the Vegas Grand Prix, because I think there is obviously a novelty factor to this race. This is going to be unlike anything we've seen before.
Well, Tom, I know you're always chomping at the bit to get into the numbers. He gives me a wry smile as I say that. But there's a bit of a mixed bag from Formula One's perspective so far? So on the one hand, there is the good news. Kieran, you've already mentioned the $1.2 billion that's being thrown around as the financial benefit to the state of Nevada. There's the $100 million in sponsorship revenue, which is, I think, is already a record for any Formula One race. More than 22 partners signed up as part of that. However, there are some slightly more concerning figures in terms of local interest or fan interest, I guess. And these numbers came from Joe Pompliano, but looking at a month-on-month drop in the prices of tickets and the prices of hotels in the region. So from the sort of 8th of October to the 8th of November, tickets for the Thursday have dropped by nearly 60%. Tickets for the Friday have dropped by the same figure. Tickets for the Saturday have dropped by 35%. And hotels for those nights have dropped by about 60% in price. So basic economics, and don't quote me on this because I didn't do very well on this at school, but the basics of supply and demand say that if prices are dropping, so is demand.
Like, we run events at SportsPay, right? We know how the events business works in terms of like the ticket sales process, and the fact that, okay, yeah, you're seeing numbers drop and prices slash. It's quite an outward figure. I think people are probably tracking this closer than they might track a regular Grand Prix. But aside from the really established ones, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a trend that you saw more broadly across, like, the not just the F1 like events portfolio, but general motorsports portfolios. Like, as close as you get closer to the time, you're going to want to try and fill up those bums in seats. And the best way to do that is to drop the prices. There was also some data at the start of this that said that this was the most expensive Grand Prix to visit. It cost an average of about $5,900 to attend this race. An average is obviously taking in like the most amount and the least amount that someone's going to spend. So the actual price for the regular punter, I don't know precisely what that is, but if that's your average price, that suggests that the top end is actually pretty high. If that's coming down, then maybe that's not that much of a surprise if it started off quite high. I think probably we won't know how well this is sold and what the performance of this is until post-event. That sounds like it should be stating the obvious, but I think trying to project based on falling numbers of ticket demand, especially when this would be the third race in the US this season, but the fourth in North America, when you've also got the Mexico Grand Prix, which geographically isn't too far away. There's a lot there for sort of North American F1 fans to get their hands on. If you're going to pick one, maybe you're not picking the one that's got an average cost of $5,800 for your weekend.
But if we're talking about Las Vegas being that apogee of excess and glitz and glamour and expenditure as well, right? I'm sure that was one of the crucial driving factors in taking the race there. Is there not a concern that it hasn't sold out?
Probably. If that proves to be the case and it hasn't sold out, then F1 might look at some of that pricing and some of the positioning of this and like have to figure out a new method. Or they will be like, we still believe this is it and it will work. We just need more time. And it might be a first race kind of syndrome. I mean, I think there were definitely teething problems with the Miami race. I don't think there's any race that doesn't go through peaks and troughs in terms of interest. I guess the other element of this is just that F1 is still not the biggest week-on-week draw in terms of motorsport in America. Like, there are other things that people care about and other things that people watch. So then asking people to translate from being big fans of Drive to Survive, like watching races on ESPN, to actually attending races and committing, like, if you're a really serious F1 fan and you want to go to all of them, like, you're spending like upwards of $10,000, it seems, on doing so. So there's a lot of factors in play there. And like, the fact that it hasn't sold out, it might be a concern, it might not. I'm sure they'll have internal targets, which we'll probably hear about only after the fact.
Just to pick up on that, I think it's easy to forget how much the Austin race at the Circuit of the Americas struggled when it joined the calendar. It wasn't until about 2016 or 2017 that it started to see an upturn in ticket sales and attendance.
How long was that from its first race?
I think it was 4 or 5 years down the line before it started seeing that advancement. So I think it's important to remember that I think the American audience does take a while to sort of attach itself to these things. I mean, COTA is now one of the favourites on the calendar. So I think you just need that sort of time for people to adapt. Obviously, going back to the fact that Vegas hasn't sold out, I know that the cheapest general admission ticket was $500 for the weekend. Those sold out instantly because that was the most affordable way for someone to attend. And that price point is right at the top level for a general admission ticket for an F1 race. So when you've got that sort of additional cost, obviously people are going to reconsider going to this kind of event. This event seems like a race targeted at a very specific type of fan. And I think it's going to be, you know, filled with celebrities, to be honest.
I think there's almost a marketability element, isn't there, to having prices so sky high and really leaning into that sense of exclusivity and targeting the one percenters of American society. But the balance between that fan interest, I guess, or the commercial success from a fan point of view, but a partner point of view, there'll be a big test of concept when they are already accessing the highest ever partnership revenue for a Grand Prix before, you know, a single tyre has even touched the tarmac.
Cold tyre as well.
Cold.
We want to get back onto tyre temperatures, Tom?
Knew you'd come around in the end.
I think that one of the sort of really telling examples of the kind of partner that they brought onto this, right, is American Express. That kind of tells a story in itself. So American Express, I think, is brought in for, it's a regional partnership for North America. That's a deal that couldn't exist a couple of years ago because you only had one US Grand Prix, and speaks to the kind of the tier of partner that F1 is able to bring in. Amex doesn't really sponsor a lot of sporting events, and the ones it does are seriously blue chip, and I include Brighton Hove Albion in that.
You've been waiting all day to say that.
I have. I have indeed. But what's that product? That product is a financial services product for people who are able to spend a lot of money. And it's sponsoring three races in the market where there is people with a lot of money, frankly. And so the fact that you're able to pitch that and take them to this event and say, this is super exclusive, here's our super exclusive sponsors. It's a unique thing that F1 has been able to build just from its work in that market in the last few years.
Now, Kian, I wanted to sort of pick your brains and see where this Grand Prix sits within the wider Formula One landscape. It's no doubt, and very, very well covered on this podcast and many others, that the US is the sort of Formula One's new frontier. It's this new growth opportunity, the very well covered effective drive to survive on American audiences, the increased viewership, new broadcast deals, etc. Without wanting to recap old ground too much, where do you think this sits on the Formula One US journey? Is it all sort of, you know, all rosy in the garden, growth, 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 or is it a bit more to the narrative than that?
I think it's tough to say at the moment, because it's important to remember that on track, Formula One isn't really at its best at the moment. We're seeing, I think, statistically the most dominant season by a driver in F1 history in terms of win percentage. Audiences are obviously going to turn off to that in comparison to recent years. So I think it's hard to say whether sort of F1 has reached its peak in the US, because obviously audience are going to stagnate whilst we're sort of sitting through this domination. But whether there's room for growth if cars, you know, get closer together at the front, you know, it's difficult to say. F1 is obviously, you know, still growing. It's grown revenues 24% in Q3 of this year. I think there's still room for F1 in the US, especially when you sort of compare it to other motorsport series like NASCAR. Their viewership is a lot higher than F1's. There is that motorsport audience there for Formula One. It's just, how can they access that whilst they're not really offering a competitive on-track offering?
So looking at that chicken and egg, what needs to come first? I'm just looking at some of the ESPN audience figures from this year. I know there is sort of at best a plateau in viewing numbers from 2023 to 2022, maybe a slight, you know, marginal percentage decrease in viewers this year compared to last. So is it just a case of, you know, we've ridden that early wave, it's now about consolidating and driving that growth further? Or is it, this is an on-track problem? We're seeing uncompetitive racing and, dare I say it, quite boring racing. Sorry to all the huge motorsport fans out there for that. But, you know, what's driving that, or is it a combination of the two?
So I mean, the good news for F1, I think, on this is that, like, they are early in this ESPN rights deal. So they're not at the point where they're having to kind of prove the value, which is good, because they had very strong growth in the last couple of years, building up to the renewal, got the big money renewal. And fortunately for them, it seems like the season where it's not been that interesting and they haven't been able to like really build on that has come at like in early on in that cycle. To your point about competitiveness, and Kian, probably you can chime in on this as well, that definitely has an impact, right? If you're watching something where you already know what the result is going to be, what's the point of watching it? So there'll be definitely, I think, changes that are coming and will come that will hopefully for F1 mean that on-track product improves And I'm sure they're thinking about it in the way of like, okay, we need to make sure this is the case when we come into that renewal cycle. But in terms of like the US market and how that's locked up with TV, it's kind of actually on ESPN at the moment to make that work. Yes, obviously Formula One plays a role. It sets the rules, it sets the races up. It needs its product to be competitive. But ESPN, they're in that buy element of the cycle where they've got this product. How do we make it work? We can't just sit there and go, it's the race's fault.
Kian, are you able to give a bit more context on that, where Formula One sits in the US in terms of its media rights, when the latest deal was signed, how long it lasts, et cetera, et cetera?
So the most recent extension was signed in 2022, I believe, and it expires in 2025, which, interestingly, on the argument of competitive balance, I think we're probably set for Red Bull dominance until the end of 2025 with the way the regulations are set. Obviously, you know, a positive outlook. Maybe a car can close up to Red Bull over the next two seasons. A realistic point of view is that Red Bull will keep improving and will probably enjoy this dominance for two more years. The regulations reset in 2026. That will probably be the best chance for a reset of the order. But it just so happens that that is the first year of the next deal for whoever takes over the rights, whether ESPN renew. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how expectations are realigned for that media rights deal if we do get two more years of dominance.
As a Lewis Hamilton fan there, Kian, you pour quite a lot of cold water all over my hopes and dreams. Feeding into that, obviously, we all know that social media is a perfect replica of society, and what people say on social media is a true representation of general debate and discourse. That goes without saying, obviously. Tongue very firmly in cheek there. But BuzzRadar released a report a couple of months ago in terms of the social media engagement with Formula One, and it made pretty grim reading. So mentions falling by 70%. New followers down 50% year on year, reach down 64% year on year, and words like boring and disappointing appearing more and more as part of the social media discourse. How much of a cause for concern is that for Formula One? You've talked about the two-year cycle leading into ESPN. If the current trend continues, it's certainly a much, much tougher product to sell to an audience in the US used to competitive balance being baked into sporting regulation and sporting structures.
I mean, obviously, Elon Musk was mentioned. I don't know how much of this downturn has been due to sort of the changes that have gone on at Twitter, or X, if you want to call it that. But obviously, things have changed on that platform, and the way things are recorded and the way, you know, tweets come up on your feed, that's all changed. I don't know how much of that has influenced this downturn, but I think there obviously has been, you know, to talk about the competitive balance again, sort of that dominance has obviously caused people to switch off a little bit. As you say, terms like boring and disappointing, you know, increasing in regularity, it sort of is now just a case of you watch Max Verstappen take the first corner in the lead and you know the result of the race.
Yeah, I mean, also on that as well, like providing additional context to that. So Elon Musk and X is born part of this. TikTok is also not growing at the same rate it was before. So like that follower growth being down by 50%, obviously a concern. But Formula One was starting from a very low base. When Liberty Media took over, it made a very, very concerted push to grow all of those channels. And that has a ceiling. So your growth, if you're rocketing up that quickly, that is going to slow down. And when you factor in other elements of that, X, TikTok not growing quite as fast as it was before in their key markets anyway. Those all play into that narrative. I think probably, like, looking ahead, one thing that could really be a bit of a beacon for Formula One in the US, not only this Vegas Grand Prix, but potentially the addition of a new American team, that will, without a doubt, have a positive impact. And how big that is remains to be seen, but it will have a positive impact on the interest of Americans. Like, let's face it, Haas are not the most interesting team to follow. The narratives at the moment in F1 are mostly around drivers that are not from the US.
Unless you watch Drive to Survive, in which case Haas is a key narrative.
Yeah, but even then, that's the Italian director of sport, essentially. But yeah, if you have an American team, American owners, maybe potentially American drivers, who knows? But that would again, that's something else that you could attach a marketing campaign, a sales campaign to a broadcaster, to an audience that will help build up that profile in the US for F1.
And that is obviously with the huge asterisk as to whether they actually get accepted, just to make that obviously clear. FIA have said Andretti are welcome to join. Formula One itself now has to approve on a commercial basis. And you don't need to do much reading to find out Formula One and the team's opinions on Andretti joining the grid. So I think there's still a long way to go on this one.
And so we'll keep an eye on that as and when it comes through. Now, I know one of the bugbears of the motorsport community is an excessive focus on Formula One. So, you know, having already riled certain members up with comments that the races aren't as fascinating, I thought, Kian, we'd pick your motorsport expertise brains in terms of other areas around the industry, in particular looking at NASCAR and their upcoming media rights deal.
Yeah, so obviously the rights currently sit with Fox and NBC, about $8 billion deal. It's up for renewal. I think 2025 is the first year of the new deal. As far as I know, it looks set to stay with Fox and NBC, but with some significant reductions to that. They've already lost the second tier Xfinity series to the CW network in a 7-year, $800 million deal. So you're going to have to consider, you know, NASCAR realigning their expectations, you know, with Fox and NBC's expenditure without that second tier product. They're also looking to offer, I believe, a mid-season package of races, which will touch on the streaming angle. But I think Amazon and Warner Brothers Discovery are in pole position to secure that. I think it's 6 to 8 races that will be on offer on streaming. That will be NASCAR's first real foray into the streaming sphere. Obviously, races are available on Peacock, but Peacock viewership isn't that impressive in the US. So it'll be interesting to see sort of how that sort of all combines together to create this next media rights deal.
I just say with that midsummer package, it was with TNT, I believe, in the current cycle. Is that right?
A few years ago now. I think it was, I'm not sure on the exact year, but I think it was 2015 or 2016, the last time that sort of mid-season package was available. So they're looking to, I guess, revisit that and reposition a little bit on their media rights strategy.
It seems for NASCAR, this has been an interesting build-up to this renewal. There was a talk a few years ago of a really big push going into streaming, and that seems to have changed a little bit. Fox, talking very recently, Lachlan Murdoch mentioned it in their most recent earnings call, that deal is on the verge of completion or nearing being done. So that's obviously a very key element of Fox Sports' rights portfolio. And yeah, as Kian mentioned, NBC look likely to renew as well. But the fact that they've been able to create or even had another section of rights to sell out to a potential digital player, that follows kind of the pattern in the US media market. So obviously, the NFL have done that most famously. The NBA look like they're going to do something similar. The NHL have done it in a more minor way with NHL TV being on ESPN+. But yeah, it looks like that's kind of what we're trending towards. But the ability of NASCAR to sell its second tier series for like $800 million to another network says that it thinks it can probably end up with a much bigger overall rights fee by breaking things up a little bit more. Being able to do that deal for, yeah, secondary standard races or a lot of content for the person that buys it, yeah, it speaks to that NASCAR is probably in maybe a better position than it was a few years ago when it came to thinking about how it was going to divvy up this rights package.
Any risks you see, Kian, associated with fragmenting the rights?
I think it's tough to say. NASCAR viewership figures are trending downwards. So would you call a change in approach a risk if they're trying to arrest that slide? I think trying something new is something that NASCAR hasn't been famously good at in recent years. We've only just recently started to see them, you know, expand out and try new things. We had the Chicago Street Race this season, which was the first time NASCAR has ever held a street race. It pulled in over 4 million viewers on average. And that was despite, I think it was an hour long rain delay, which for that kind of race is really impressive and shows that the demand is there. I think NASCAR was maybe resting on its laurels a little bit and just sort of riding the wave of stagnation in terms of viewership without really doing much to sort of affect things in a positive way. But we're now starting to see a little bit of change in that regard. Whether that will then result in a boost in viewership remains to be seen.
And they're also building out their media capability, right? They've invested in those facilities and invested in, I mean, even really simple stuff like getting influencers along to your races and bringing in high profile team owners, like that stuff. But like, it seems kind of quite cosmetic, but it can make a big difference.
Yeah, and to your point, they've also created an archive of every NASCAR race online, available for free for anyone to watch. It's all part of, I guess, just building up this fandom that maybe they haven't sort of catered for before. I think races are available on the archive within a week or two of the race airing, which, I mean, to have that sort of on offer for free for anyone to watch is, I think, a more progressive step than you would expect for a typical motorsport series.
and like more progressive step than you take for NASCAR, which isn't a series you do immediately associate with the word progression.
I think that's an understatement.
Well, on that note, Tom and Kian, thank you very much for joining me this week. I hope you guys are looking forward to the second greatest show on earth after, of course, the Sports Web podcast this weekend. We'll catch up next week.
Cheers, George.
Cheers, George.